There we go. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of InForum, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find InForum online at inforumsf.org. I'm Kiki Sanford, the host of This Week in Science, and we are here tonight with Christian Rutter, the co-founder of the online dating company OkCupid. And he's also the author of this new book, Dataclysm, Who We Are When We Think No One Is Looking. Christian Rutter is OkCupid's co-founder. He's a Harvard mathematics graduate and the mastermind behind OkCupid's popular OkTrends blog. He's made a name for himself by mining big data to reveal the surprising realities of human behavior. And now in Dataclysm, he looks to harness the potential of online information to do everything from predicting the next election cycle to marketing products more efficiently to understanding our societal hang-ups. We're thrilled to have him here today to help us unpack who we are when we don't think anyone is looking. So let's get started. If we can welcome Christian Rutter to the stage, please.
Hi.
How
are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for joining us this evening.
It is my pleasure.
I'm curious, coming from such a varied background, you're not just a Harvard-trained mathematician, founder of a startup popular dating site, but also a musician. There are all these transitions you've had throughout your career. Have they been jolts in your life, or has everything flowed easily from one thing to the next?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I was a math major, so I wouldn't say I was like Harvard-trained mathematician. I don't want anyone thinking there's like some beautiful mind thing going on. I started a band with my friend, and around the same time that I started OkCupid with three other friends. And so those two things kind of were going in parallel for a while, and the band was occupying a lot of my time. I don't know, there was like no real plan. It was just kind of like doing things that sort of grew of their own, and mostly because I worked with great people. Definitely not one of these people that has gone and planned. You know, you meet people as a freshman everywhere, but especially at Harvard, that are like, you know, I'm going to Harvard Law, and I'm going to be on the law review, and then I'm going to work at Skadden or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely not one of those people in many ways. They're kind of the opposite. So, there's a lot of luck involved in any of this stuff too. So, yeah.
But. Did music lead you into math, which led you into data, or did math lead you to music, or is it all a wrapped up story?
I'm kind of about it good at both of them, equivalently good at the two things, but it's not like I'm like a virtuoso at either one again. So like
a ukulele.
Yeah, I'm an all right ukulele player, I think it does. Especially music these days and working with data, the most important thing that you can train yourself to do is to just sit in front of a computer for a long time. So, you know, that's not a joke, for real. So you're just sitting in front of Pro Tools and you're just like, God damn it. And, you know, spacebar, open Apple spacebars, you know, all of this, anyone who's ever done this, and you just are just cranking it out. And it works the same way, at least the way, but writing is almost the same way too these days. So it's just being diligent and highly focused, I think. That is the one thing that unites them. I mean, I got into math because, like many people, I liked baseball, and there was this game Stratomatic that had that had these cards. It was you roll dice. It was way before fantasy baseball, and certainly way before the internet. I would play. This was like '86 and '87, and I would play with a couple friends, and he would always draft, you know, like Don Mattingly and Andre Dawson, these like dudes with the big names. But I realized that you could get the way the cards worked is you could have somebody who had 100 at bats and happened to be pretty good. That were like Cal Daniels is like a miracle Stratomatic card from '87. He's a totally forgotten player, but because he had a few at bats and happened to hit a bunch of home runs, his card is amazing. It's better than anyone else's. So I kind of like learned how to abuse statistics and my friends that way.
Perfect.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. That's that answer.
And so You moved into co-founding OkCupid after working with SparkNotes.
Yeah, my other three co-founders of OkCupid, they started SparkNotes, and yeah. I got that job. I was like one of the first employees and kind of did a lot of the public-facing part of it. Mm-hmm. And we all worked. We had a really great dynamic. And you know, just became friends, honestly. And then, even though they went to Harvard, but I didn't know them. And then we were kind of all left Barnes & Noble because Barnes & Noble bought SparkNotes, and it was kind of like, and we didn't like working there. So we wanted to do something else together, and OkCupid was kind of the answer to what that would be.
Nice.
Yeah.
And
somewhat nice.
Was it
at first.
In being the kind of public-facing first person from SparkNotes, is that how you ended up doing the blog? For yeah. OkCupid?
Yeah, it is actually. Yeah, I mean, there's this division of labor among the four of us where Max does all the kind of like hardcore computer science, Sam does all the sort of hardcore business, Chris does the kind of product and the JavaScript and that kind of thing, and I kind of do the editorial and work with Chris. And so for a while, and this is actually how I ended up spending so much time on the band, especially because on a dating site, there isn't a ton of editorial. people don't appreciate it if you're going to editorialize, honestly, and unless you're doing like dating tips or whatever, and like, you know, that's a kind of I'd rather blow my brains out type situation. So
top 10 ways too.
Right, exactly. That. So then we had the idea that in the course of running the business, trying to figure out who likes who and like all the crazy stuff that's going on, who wants to sleep together, who's describing themselves in what way or another, we realized we were learning all this stuff about just people and mm-hmm. that it could make interesting content. And the first instinct was like, all right, let's get a PR company to kind of craft these press releases. And we ended up with a lot of kind of like very dull, like, you know, it's like something about the Super Bowl teams and who had the hottest fans, like this kind of thing. The thing you would see in like kind of a crappy like gesture towards statistics in a newspaper, you know. and so we kind of unplugged that and decided to do it ourselves, and that job fell to me. So.
Yeah. And from there came the book.
Yeah. So then I worked on the blog for, God, it's only 2 years, really. That's crazy. Anyway, so 2 years, and then. It occurred to me that there were a lot of people doing really interesting, similar and interesting things at like Facebook and Google, because more people were starting to publish stuff about like culture and human behavior that they had found, and so the book is my attempt to sort of collect the stuff that I do at OkCupid with the things that they're doing. I mean, you know, and just to be clear to everybody, you know, that like the description of the book as like this kind of like big reveal on the entirety of humanity is obviously. Overselling it a little bit. I mean, I think it's a great read for sure, but I don't want anyone in the audience to sit here thinking that like the entirety of all of our lives are lived on these sites. I mean, it's more of a gesture towards where these things are going and a kind of a discussion of the social science that already goes on and has been going on for a while. You know, people, as soon as I started publishing the blog on OkCupid, you know, just every week at least somebody who's doing a postdoc or a PhD or our professors would be like, oh my God, please, we would love to have your data, you know? And because it's true, I mean, it's really awesome data for a lot of questions, you know? And so that's kind of what the book is about, is how this data can be good. And all the things that it answers is they're relatively narrow questions one at a time, but it's you know, it's a gesture where things are going. Just to, you know, because even the subtitle, like, I don't choose how that works. You must know how that is. So that's a publisher jam.
Yeah, the subtitle, I was actually wondering about that because it's the whole when we think nobody's looking. But
sure.
The thing is, when you're crafting your online persona, you're creating it for people to look at. Mm-hmm. And so you're actually not necessarily doing things the way that you normally would because you're trying to create...
Right, sure. I mean,
something that
online
people
dating,
are going to like.
Right,
yeah.
Right, exactly. That's the perfect way to put it, is you're trying to create a version of yourself that is more likable.
Yeah.
which is kind of what I'm doing here. So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, not that I'm disowning the subtitle at all, because it is that's one of the most interesting things about the book, is that you can... It's interesting to look at the space between what people have to say about themselves and the image they're trying to project, and then what they go and do. And especially on a dating site, because that image is so intended to be a best foot forward, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, the way people act out their love lives are often in the most it's things that make you very cynical, let me put it that way. So, you know, they excise these kind of like, it can be dark. So it's cool to go compare those two things, especially in the OkCupid data set, you know. So.
Yeah, and as you're looking and trying to pull from the OkCupid data set particularly, do you think it really does represent human behavior? Because it's not necessarily what people would really do. It's kind of like when you're taking a personality test online or something.
Sure.
People sometimes don't answer honestly because they think they should answer a particular way.
Oh, for sure. I mean, definitely people lie to the computer that is asking them questions all the time. And that's why, I guess, like in the book, I especially try to focus on more like observe stuff where people are voting on each other and sending messages. Like you don't lie about, you know, people don't send messages to people to like spoof OkCupid for some reason. I mean, that's like just, I mean, I do people, we might ask people about their views on the world directly, right. And then they are going to project an image even to us, even though there's no person with a clipboard taking it down. But but in terms of voting and all that stuff, I really try to focus on that behavior and only look at the sort of self-reported stuff as an artifact of self-reporting, I guess.
Right. So yeah. There's probably always going to be that artifact in there. How do you think?
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, there is. I mean, this is an important thing, especially for people who haven't done online dating, which I also have not, but who don't know people who do it all the time. Maybe you're older or you've been married for a long time. Like, you know, that it's not this kind of thing where people have these like long protracted kind of epistolary relationships back and forth over email, like a you've got mail type of deal where they're having this thing and then there's this big reveal, oh my God, you're just like your picture, and then they hug or whatever. You know, it's way more like 3 or 4 or 5 messages, hey, let's go get a drink, and then they figure all that stuff out. Like the entirety of the romance happens offline, you know? So in a sense, like people put themselves out there in a particular way and in a motivated way, especially in their profile text and the picture they choose of themselves. But it is ultimately fact-checked relatively quickly and repeatedly by other people. There is a reality check. You can't use a photo that's 5 years or 10 years out of date. I'm 5'10 or something, and I couldn't say that I was 6'3 and then I lifted weights all the time if I thought that was a good idea, you know, because like I'm going to show up to that date and the person who's going to be there is not going to be happy with the person that has arrived to go on a date with them. And it's just a burn on me. Like there's very little incentive for this kind of catfishing thing, which I know just for the sake of clarity, because online dating especially used to be so stigmatized. It just kind of doesn't work like that anymore, just to be clear. So
all the information that you're collecting from people, how do you store it? What do you do with it?
Well, I mean, we store, like, basically, just like any site, like anything, you know, most of you guys probably know this, but anything you do on a computer ends up somewhere on a server in a database, right? Sometimes that's just so they can recall it again and then show it back to you. Like, Facebook obviously stores who your friends are so that when you go to Facebook, you can see who your friends are. That's, like, the point of the experience. Or they store, like, what things you've been clicking on so that presumably they can show you more of the stuff that you like to click on. Or they store this information so that they can show you things you might want to buy. And same with OkCupid, you know, we store your messages because we need to be able to show them back to you when you go to your inbox. We store who you've messaged for the same reason, and also, again, especially the who, so we can go look at successful conversations. And nobody looks at on an individual level what happens. It's all aggregated, but we have to have individual data that we can aggregate, right? I mean, basically anything you do, anything you've clicked on, we can go get it. If we're not kind of keeping it highly granularly at the time, there's always web logs that we can go back and get if we decide we needed that data point for a bunch of people.
Right. So even though your current algorithm may not use certain data points currently,
in theory, yeah, we could go back.
You
and
could go
it.
Back and
yeah, yeah.
add them
and,
in.
And there's tons of the matching algorithm, the way we recommend people to you from the sea of OkCupid profiles out there, we can only show you 10 at a time, so we have to figure out how that works. So or whatever, 10, 20, something. So there's that. That's kind of the main thing, like match. But there's tons of other kind of logics in every site too, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Facebook like button, and this is something that's come up recently that I think is interesting. There have been a couple of articles, one in which somebody a journalist decided to like everything on Facebook.
He said it
just destroyed his feed. his feed turned into just all sponsored posts and stuff from Salon and Huffington Post and various news agencies, and he lost all his friends.
He got the like optimist feed, just the feed. Dude who likes everything.
Yeah.
Great.
And then the opposite has happened recently, where a number of people have stopped liking entirely, and that's something that I've tried, because I noticed that I did not like my feed anymore.
Yeah.
And so I decided to stop liking anything. I don't like comments. I don't like any posts. And if I do like something, I go into the comments and I write like in it.
Oh, they know that. I guarantee that they're measuring the fact that you're commenting on
Yeah.
things. It's a little bit of self-defeat there.
Right. But the things that I'm commenting on, I'm interacting
of course,
more.
Of course, yeah.
Do you think that is going to, how would that kind of change in user behavior affect?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would fuck it up for sure. I mean, you know, like, because the way these things work, you know, like anytime there's a recommendation algorithm on a website, whether it's OkCupid trying to recommend a match for you, or Facebook trying to recommend some news you might want to see, or an ad you might want to see for that matter, or Google, you search for diapers, and you know that's their best guess at what you're going to like, is that top thing, you know, except for the mm-hmm. sponsored content. And that opinion, that's a guess, and that guess is ultimately the guess of whoever wrote the software, whether it's 100 people or one person or whatever. It's some people, you know, that they had to figure out what this computer is going to spit back. So if you're, just like you're trying to trick a person, basically, you know, mm-hmm. or playing like a shell game, it's never going to be able to figure it out. Which is, you know, like, if, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, what you do when you don't like stuff. Like, it's easy to kind of give it positive feedback, but how do you, I guess they don't have a dislike button so that
right.
it doesn't become a real situation over there with so much disliking. But but yeah, that is probably a blind spot, and I'm sure that there's ways that they account for it. Like, if you, I mean, what I would do in that situation, I have no idea what they do. But if I, you know, it's showing you stuff that you don't like, well, they basically just triage out all the, if you've been seeing news from 15 people and you haven't liked it for a couple of days, well, bye-bye, you know, and then they'll swap in another 15 more or
right.
whatever, you know. So, but yeah.
Yeah, I just find it interesting the fact that we are giving this information. And when we, any app for our mobile devices or for desktops, whatever, any site or app that we say, I'm going to use this, and we accept the terms and conditions,
oh, yeah.
everything that we do is then data that is owned by that company, collected and owned by that company.
Yeah, definitely. That's true.
Yeah. And then...
I mean...
yes.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, and that comes down to a thing where, like, I understand why you might not... To think that some kind of pattern of behavior of yours is then the property or the grist for some mill that programmers have made. Like, if you don't trust those people, the implication there, if you're uncomfortable with that, is that you don't trust them, right? And
right.
like, then if you shouldn't, just like you wouldn't want to go to a restaurant where you don't trust the chefs or whatever. Like, you shouldn't go use the thing, you know. And Yeah, it's a complex thing, because that information is also used to actually do things that you like, or why you're there in the first place. In an OkCupid example, like, you're there to like find people to talk to, and we need to know, we can't read your mind, you know?
No.
Right. So if you're not doing anything, if you're like withholding from the site, then we have nothing to go on, and like, you know, there's a certain symbiosis required, you know.
Yeah, there's a certain honesty that's required on the part of the user, and also transparency on the part of the companies that are collecting the data.
Sure. Yeah.
What is okay? You mentioned also that you get requests from academics and other people for your data. What's the policy of OkCupid for actually letting people go through the data and try and find correlations?
We try to accommodate anybody that's doing work that we think is cool, and that can be done without in an anonymous way.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you can hash user IDs so that you can't back out who it is. You can do that poorly and then have people back it out, but I think we're all right at it. We've only done this maybe 5 or 6 times, but you know, if people want to investigate the effect of distance on relationships through our data set. You know, that's a pretty simple thing that you can deliver to these people where it doesn't, there's no personally identifiable information in there. It's basically a big table of, you know, pseudonyms essentially, mm-hmm. and like who contacted who and how far apart they were. And that's the kind of thing that we do.
The idea of, from Dataclism, you get into the idea of big data. Mm-hmm. And there's this question currently of what is big data and where is humanity in conjunction with the data that we're collecting and we're mining and we're trying to figure out recommendations for the best things for people to do, how right. we live our lives, everything about us, but how do they meld in your mind?
How does the
data, how important the data and the large data sets and mining that data for information for how we're going to lead our lives. How does, in your mind, how does that meld with just being people?
Well, I mean, I think that this, you know, I guess that kind of speaks to the reason I wrote the book is because people do live so much of their lives through these technologies, whether it's through your phone or your laptop or whatever, that this is just kind of like the story of how that life is lived through these things, right? So it's a little yep. bit of reportage. But you know, like without data, for example, without even just if Facebook had, I don't know, if OkCupid didn't have any match questions, you know, and didn't record who looked at who and who liked who or whatever, like the best thing that literally the best thing that we could offer at that point would be a list of people that was essentially unsorted, you know,
right,
and so that makes the site worse, possibly to the point of not being worth visiting, right? Because it's just a list. You don't need a list of random New Yorkers is worthless, you know. But you know, I mean, for real. So you need to be able to prioritize. There's too much mm-hmm. there. If it were 10 people on OkCupid, we could introduce you to every single one, regardless of what they had to say about anything, you know, because that's small. But we've got to pull 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 people from 100,000. And say these are who I think you're going to enjoy talking to, you know. And I guess people like some of the people that we've worked with, like sociologists or the people that work at Facebook who do just basically strictly academic research, mm-hmm. you know, I think they are trying to answer you know human interest questions about how people behave in these settings, you know.
Yeah. I think it's really the first time that, I mean, these companies really are the first opportunity for sociologists to really have data sets, huge data sets about yeah. people's choices and their behavior.
Right, exactly. Choices, that's a great point, is that there's so much about behavioral science, especially of a certain type, is about how people make choices, you know? And a dating site is a great example for that, or looking at what political content people click on in their Facebook feeds is a great mm-hmm. example of a similar but different type of question. And so, yeah, that is exactly why I think when we started publishing stuff, sociologists realized, like, obviously the research on OK Trends is not, you know, scholarship in that sense of it could be in Nature or something like this.
Right.
But they're like, shit, this answers the thing. This really speaks to this question I've been investigating, you know? And so there's a lot of excitement. Even, you know, it's a thing that's in this whole enterprise of social media or these websites, period, is only like 8 or 10 years old, and the kind of data side of it is only 3 or 4 or 5. So it's still something that people are sorting out, for sure.
Yeah. Do you feel like there are any areas of huge growth that are still to come? Like anything that you feel like is percolating on the edges of development?
On the data side.
On the data side, yeah.
God, man. I don't know. There's a big push-pull because, you know, people, especially Facebook, just because they're such a lightning rod one way or the other, you know, mm-hmm. they publish things and then there's people are upset and they pull back.
Basically, they publish things, people are upset.
it does happen. I mean, you know, look, I'm not trying to boost any one particular company up, but there's no question that there's an incredible amount of scrutiny on what they do and
yeah.
probably justifiably, right? But yeah, I mean, I don't think, I forget the future. I think people are still trying to sort out the present in a certain sense too. You know, mm-hmm. I think there's a, I guess that's my answer to your question. I think, I don't know where it's going, because I think people are still trying to absorb even what is, you know, they're like, there's a billion people who check Facebook every month in the world, and they can't even use it in China. So that's like one in every five or six like non-Chinese people on Earth use the site. And that's not a joke. I'm just mean like that's just a fact. Yeah. The penetration is insane. And people often think, you know, it's just like an American thing or whatever, a Silicon Valley thing maybe, or it's a middle class thing or whatever. But these technologies are approaching true ubiquity, like global ubiquity, you know, and that. It is, there's the part of that realization is also, oh my God, we can go look at how people in small communities or villages in Southeast Asia or in the Middle East or in Africa are like kind of picking up en masse and moving in Thailand, they move to Bangkok or whatever, or these like travel patterns that it's the like amount of the types of questions and the types of insight that scientists using this data can get is just like truly different than what was able to be reached before. Whereas like in the Great Migration in the United States in the early part of last century, you know, it's a thing that historians would go back and look at kind of scattershot documents and talk about. It was a known thing. It wasn't like it was an undiscovered phenomenon, but the amount of precision and detail that we can see if that kind of thing happening in other places now is just exponentially greater, you know. And I think people are still trying to absorb the potential of all of just the current state of affairs, I guess.
Do you think that things have been moving so rapidly, 8 years, 10 years, 3 to 5 for the data? Do you think it has just been moving too rapidly for people to be able to absorb that? That's part of it. There's so much progress so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I was going to say it's an open question whether it's progress. Like, I'm definitely not a kind of person who believes that every single new technology is automatically an improvement on the current state of affairs.
I'm not saying progress as improvement, progress as change.
Sure, got it. So, I mean, I definitely think the pervasiveness of these technologies far outstrips the comprehension of how they work, for sure. You know, because as the kind of outcry over Facebook's and then OkCupid's experiments, that is something that every person in the tech world takes for granted, that you test different kinds of things and algorithms can recommend X when maybe it, in another situation it could have recommended Y. So I think the distance between these two things is closing, but I think there is still a gap between the sort of practice of using these things and the reality of how the things function. And I think the closing of that gap can only be good for everybody involved.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's something maybe people don't realize that for years in advertising, there's been this kind of testing, the A-B testing. You put something out, see how sample group responds, you change it, your messaging is always changed as a result. And
right. I mean, and people just in advertising is a good example, because that is even beyond the A-B testing. I think that is something in the 50s or the 60s, you might assume that doctor in the Virginia Slims ad or whatever it is really does sit around and smoke these cigarettes all the time, which he might do, but the whole idea of like a paid spokesman is an idea that people took a while to catch on to, that, wait a second, this dude is getting paid to be in this ad. It is not a reflection of his real life, you know?
Yeah.
And people have just become more sophisticated about marketing, and people now are just like, you've trained yourself to ignore it. And I think there is a current, I think that process of discovery is happening now in about, you know, the way social websites work.
Yeah, on the digital side of things.
Yeah, exactly.
And back to your book, as you were working through it, was there anything that just surprised you, that was just an exciting find, that you're like, oh man, I'm so excited I get to write about this?
I generally enjoy writing about the OkCupid stuff, because it's just like, it's so easy to get to feel spoiled by it, because the data is so great and it's just, there's so much of it. If on the other side of things, like I think I for the book, I also gathered kind of my own Twitter corpus. And so I, you know, was looking at it, and one surprise was somewhat negative, and that and when you're sitting down trying to write a book about data, you're like, all right, OkCupid, I'm all good on, man. There's going to be some sweet shit I'm going to find out on Twitter. And then, you know, you're looking at the stuff and you realize that Twitter doesn't actually, you exist only as an avatar on Twitter. You know, they don't know how old you are. They don't ask. where you could put that you're from Mars and your name is Zeus or whatever, and they don't, that's fine. That's just how the service works. And so one of the only things you could find out about from Twitter's data is how people use Twitter, which is not an intrinsically interesting question all the time.
It's an argument people have constantly.
and it's the same way with like Reddit or any of the sites that are sort of like purely online in a way that, say, Facebook or OkCupid is not. So I kind of had to rethink how I was going to use Twitter, and so I looked at how people write on Twitter, and I found, you know, that it's actually surprisingly sophisticated. I don't tweet that much, but, you know, like, and I assume it's a kind of morass of LOL and OMG and this kind of thing. But the average word length on Twitter is longer than it is in Shakespeare or in the work of P.G. Wodehouse. This is from a linguist at UPenn who found the same thing. I verified totally independently. And these guys at Arizona State looked at the lexical density, which is the proportion of like meaning-carrying words in a sentence or a body of text, and it's like higher on Twitter than it is like in magazine-level journalism or in like email. And I don't know, I genuinely was like, oh, that's kind of wild, you know? And that's obviously getting rid of the URL and the hashtag. Of course, they're like the limit, having limitations makes you choose your words a little bit more carefully or think how you're gonna, like German style, you know, come up with one long word that means what you wanna say rather than a bunch of really small ones. That was actually an interesting, that's one of my favorite parts. Like, working with that stuff, I was like, sweet, okay, cool.
And something
like fun to write about, yeah.
Yeah. We're going to be having audience questions in just a moment, so if anyone has questions, there's a microphone over to stage right, my right, your left, over there, if you want to line up. I am a Twitter user, and I know
you've got so many followers, I noticed.
And people always ask me, oh, you just talk about your breakfast or whatever, and it's not that at all, and I have some very high-level conversations, and it's a really interesting service.
Yeah, see, I came to it as I assume a person who knows nothing about online dating would come to OkCupid and be like, what is this dumb, like, what is, nobody uses online dating or whatever. So for me, like, seeing Twitter, I was like, yeah, I just assumed it was just all garbage, basically, you know, no offense to anyone. but you know, it was cool to find that. I mean, that's verified, for sure. So Twitter is such a weird thing. It's like, there's a certain, I feel like a personality that enjoys broadcasting his or herself one way or the other, you know, and there's personalities that don't. And it's a kind of a weird, like, psychological marker, I think, whether you like Twitter or not. So, for whatever that's
worth. Well, maybe we can look at the data for that.
Yeah, only with verified accounts, I guess.
So, I'd like to invite the first audience member ask a question.
Hi, how are you? Oh, it's my pleasure.
Closer into the microphone.
Yeah, or just
please.
Turn the mic towards your face. Yeah, that's a key.
There we go.
There you go.
So my question was, messages.
Yeah, it's true.
And in talking with my female friends, they're like, how do I deal with kind of this overload? And have you guys thought about like introducing some sort of like transaction costs or giving them sort of filters to sort of manage that?
We absolutely have. In fact, we do message filters is the thing that we've had built for a long time. But one thing that you've got to be very careful with running a site like OkCupid is that people can just blow themselves up with the tool. There's a tool that if somebody uses it correctly would make their experience a million times better. But I know because we've tested it. If you roll out this thing and they set their filters, like I only want to talk to guys who match me above this and who are, you know, height's important, so 6'2", and who live this far away from me, then they get no messages. That's like a very common outcome of people basically over-filtering, you know. So we don't offer that feature even though it's, you know, it's sitting there. It's really hard. Another way to do it would just simply be like, block. There are obviously more attractive people get more messages than OkCupid, period. You know, both men and women, but especially women, because guys are usually the people who send the first message in the first place. So, you know, you could easily just say, well, if this woman is an 8 out of 10 or whatever, and you're a 2 guy, tough luck, and just have a big X over the screen or whatever, you know, like disable the button or something. But, you know, it just would be such a burn, you know. So it's like, it's very hard to balance the, like, the burn with the balm, basically. Yeah, it's a good question because we ask that ourselves all the time.
Hello.
anyway, just be
and while we're waiting for the microphone, I'll just remind everyone to leave it
rather than adjust it for every person.
Make sure you're asking a question and not telling a story, please, so that we can allow Christian to answer as many questions as possible.
Sure, thanks.
Well, so you mentioned that this has been going on as a trend, like dating online has been around for almost a decade, depending on the site.
2 decades. Match started in 95, I think.
So, you know, I know that probably all of us have heard that cliche that 50% of marriages end in divorce.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, and we got to chat a little bit earlier, so you specifically said that the way you see, like, success, like, people that look like they want to talk to each other, was that they message back and forth a few times. And what I'm really interested in, because I met my fiance on your site, and I'm not going to tell that story, but it's like, do you do anything, and if so, like, how do you try to address whether people will be compatible long term?
So we started OkCupid in 2003, launched in 2004, and at that time, like, eHarmony was at least on par, maybe ahead of Match in terms of kind of like the world. And their whole thing was so prescriptive and so like soulmate based, and so like, you know, you could answer some questions wrong and they would like basically kick you off the site. I mean, most famously, if you said you were looking for a same-sex relationship, they invited you to leave, essentially. And we were just like, that's just, we really, OkCupid was kind of fundamentally created as a reaction against that. So to kind of get to the point, like, we really want people to be able to figure out what they want for themselves, more or less, right? And part of that is introducing people and letting them go on a date quickly, hopefully, and taking it from there. So that you know, like, the way somebody laughs could just be so obnoxious that no matter what it says in their profile, that you hate them, you know? Or the other way around, right? And that no computer is ever going to be able to get that, right? So we try to keep our purview to what we really can know and what the most narrow job that we can do as a dating site. As far as people coming back and getting married, some people do come back and tell OkCupid, like, hey, I met this guy on OkCupid and we're getting married. And, you know, people do come back and tell us that through the little interface. But it's a very highly self-selected and small proportionally subset of the people that do actually find matches. So if we actually did stuff based on that information, then we would really only be catering to this niche of people that were, like, responsible and really loved OkCupid and wanted to come back and disable their accounts. So, and if OkCupid only catered to responsible people, we'd be in big trouble. So anyway, that's just a long way to say that we really try to limit the scope of what we're trying to do. Because the whole soulmate thing is just kind of obnoxious to me.
There was one piece of data I was curious if you used, which is simply that, you know, you have people sometimes come back on the site because they maybe were off for a while because they were dating someone, they come back. Uh-huh. Do you integrate that in any kind of more systematic way?
We don't, no. Okay. We just kind of treat it as a new thing.
Thank you.
Thanks.
As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by Inforum, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. For more information about Inforum and its upcoming events, please visit us on Facebook or follow @InforumSF on Twitter. Tonight we're here with Christian Rutter, co-founder of OkCupid and author of the new book, Dataclism. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, neurophysiologist and host of This Week in Science.
Hi, my name is Nan. I'm studying venture capital right now. And I have a question on OkCupid. You know, each startup have its life circles. And I'm just wondering, like, what if, like, your startup has reached into maturity?
Uh-huh.
And what do you do next?
Well, I mean, what do you do? Has OkCupid reached maturity and what happens next? I guess in a certain sense we have. I'm the only founder who still works on the business on a daily basis. I guess it's kind of, what does a human being do when he reaches maturity? It's a question that everybody has to face, you know, like, I'm not getting any taller, you know what I mean? So we keep trying to do as good a job as we can. I've never personally been that wrapped up in, like, startup mythos or anything like this, so I don't really reflect on the fact that we're a different company than we were 5 years ago even, you know? And we're still, even now, we have fewer people than are in the first, like, 3-4 rows here. We're, like, 25 people total. So it's not, like, this big kind of scene. So I don't know. I mean, it's the thing about, especially about, with the dating site, like, unlike Facebook or unlike Google for sure, Facebook and Google are useful to you whether you're 15 or you're 45 or you're 90, really, you know? And we really only get people for the short amount of time in their life, and then they basically cycle out. So the user base refreshes, and I don't have to worry necessarily that people are bored at looking at one thing, which they might get on Facebook, for example. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah?
Hey.
Hi, how are you?
I had a question a little broader than OKCupid itself about your access to what it means, the data sets that are out there at various different places, and especially the data stewards that exist, because I expect that you know more about these people and these data sets than a lot of others. And what kind of scares you or makes you interested about the character of data or about the quality of stewardship of some of these people? Why would you reject dozens or hundreds of requests for OKCupid data usage, but carefully satisfy five or six?
Oh, for the academic questions? Sure. I mean, usually that just goes because people want to, the ones we reject most common are it's a grad student. Sorry, grad students. Or if they're trying to answer some question that we know that they can't answer either through our data period or through our data provided that it's anonymized, right? So there's only probably one or two gay 36-year-old women living in Des Moines, and if people want to need all of that stuff, then we were just like, I'm sorry, we can't do anything for you here, you know, because they can go look this stuff up and find that person. So that's basically on that side. I mean, on the steward side of, like, the people who takes care of the data at Facebook and Google, for example, I don't know. I'm sure it's not a single person. And I will say, like, the difference... Nobody at Facebook cares one way or the other what any single one of us are doing on Facebook. You know, they're trying to answer what do 18-year-old women do. That's probably about as granular as it gets. So they want to show Game of Thrones ads to people who like Game of Thrones, right? And like, or some version of that problem. So nobody's sitting in there kind of like looking up people's messages, and so they'd be immediately fired. I'm positive if they could even get that access. And it's the same way at OKCupid, even though we're smaller. But the thing that, the big kind of difference, conceptual difference, there is one place where they are doing that and looking at one person is doing, and that's like at the NSA, because they're not trying to figure out what guys are up to, you know? They're trying to figure out if they're gonna arrest somebody, like someone in particular. They're not like, oh, we need to get 10 arrests going today, let's pull a few, you know, they wanna figure out about you, you know? So that's where I think it starts to get scary. And I, you know, to my knowledge, we've never had a kind of one of these NSA requests, or I don't even know what they're called exactly, PRISM. But that's a kind of like different. That's the thing that people should be a lot more kind of scared. And I mean, people are scared and upset. But that's where it is. Like, they really are looking at what you're doing. Nobody at any of the internet companies, we care about users in the very aggregate sense. But nobody is looking up what somebody is doing and trying to like guess whether they're on vacation or whatever. It just doesn't happen. So, yeah.
Thanks.
Great question.
Hey Christian, thanks again for coming to Inforum.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Question for you.
Great.
If you could get into anyone's data sets without any repercussions, whose data sets would it be and why?
This is some kind of trap.
Sponsored by the NSA.
You know, I mean, look, Google must be able to paint an incredible picture of somebody. You know, they know, you can piece together someone's day based on their searches, their Google Maps, Gmail. I mean, that's just an insane level of granularity. Again, not that anyone is trying to do that exact thing, but if you go and aggregate that stuff, I'm sure you can find some amazing things. For the book, like, because I knew that having some random person, i.e. me, getting access to, say, Facebook or Google data was impossible, I basically looked at stuff that they had already published and that was already kind of out there and folded it in. And then also did some exploration on Google Trends and Google Ngrams, which are amazing tools. Anyone who's interested should play with them.
They're fun.
Yeah, so that's kind of, that was my own personal level of access to those things.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very impressed by the size and scope of OKCupid's data set, and I've always wondered, with online dating sites, mm-hmm. in their infancy, how do you get people to join a dating site when no one's on it?
Yeah, it's a brutal problem. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the most typical ways, which OKCupid never did, but you can buy Google AdWords and just try to to buy customers. You know, for us, we had just quit SparkNotes, and we knew people there, and we bought advertising on the front page of SparkNotes saying, hey, this is what we're up to, and we got some small group of people. But it was a long haul, you know, like this is 04 to 05, you know, we almost went out of business in 09. So we were just kind of like trucking at a very slow slope type of line, you know. And the blog was really an answer to that question. We wanted, how do you get, especially when it's a kind of stigmatized thing, just like study guides used to be, how do you get people to talk about it? And so when you generate, talk about the data and talk about all the crazy stuff people are doing, then it makes it easy for people who are already in a relationship or people to kind of in this sort of third person way be like, oh man, I read this thing on this dating site, and that people can talk about the existence of your website. So.
But how are you even able to provide that data when you only had 100 users or 500 users, whatever the number was?
Oh, I mean, we had way more than that. I mean, when I say we were struggling, we had probably our monthly actives. This is, I'm totally making a guess here because I actually don't know the number. It was probably in the low six-digit numbers at that point. But that is a shitty website, I mean, for sure. So I mean, for anyone, especially one that's trying to make money off of advertising, you know, as we were, it was basically, there was no kind of freemium model there. So that just scaled, it won't fly. So yeah, I mean, it just kind of slowly grew and we kind of got better at what we were doing. As far as how you bootstrap it, I mean, that's why there's tons of tiny dating sites that have nobody on them because it's the one thing people will actually pay for. And so people want to get in that business, right? But there's only a few that people actually use. I mean, the kind of like amount of puffery that is involved in the online dating world, like there's so many dating sites that are basically a press release and nothing else. And they like, I was reading, there was an article in the New York Times about IAC, which owns Match, Us, and Tinder. And they were trying, it was the craziest thing, one of the craziest things I've ever read in that paper. They were like trying to describe our competitors as, you know, whatever, there's JDate, which is a completely legit site. And then they're saying these niche sites, and they put in a sea captain's date. I'm not making this up, a dating site for sea captains. You guys should check it out. And it's like a joke. It is not a real site. I mean, I'm probably getting them more users by saying this than they have. but there's just so many of these things, like, you know, Ayn Rand date or whatever. That's another one. Like, for real, you laugh, right? But that's just a really crazy, wild world, the online dating scene, for sure. Check out seacaptainsdate.com.
On a broader level, what skills do you think are most relevant in becoming a data scientist? And as someone who's explored a lot of virgin data, are there any heuristics or advice you would give people who are working with fresh data and not having many priors?
Sure. I think I get asked this question occasionally, and I think one of the most important, like the math behind any of this stuff is not that hard. You know, I mean, it's somebody who's good at math can be a data scientist like this, can do the math behind data science. The hard problem is uniting that the relatively simple mathematics to an understanding of the like milieu of the data, where the data actually comes from, and like the environment that it came to you in, and then like some kind of understanding of human nature. And so like I think that heuristic of like what is motivating what I'm seeing in the data is like a very important question. And I think that's kind of how my kind of fractured personal history has actually helped me a lot, because I've done a lot of random things basically, and that gives you just context for understanding what people are doing in the data. That if you have just kind of spent all of your time in R or working on taking stats classes, you might not get, you know. And so I really, when people ask me, like, how do I get into doing data science, I think that personally the most important thing is to really try to understand people if you're dealing with data from people. If you're dealing with, you know, some financial data or something, it's kind of a different story. But yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, I have two questions,
yes.
Actually. One is big and the other one is a small question. Big question is, now it's so available to everybody, do we think about all these, I don't know, tablet sociologists happening everywhere?
Say that last part again. I just think about...
Amateur sociologists happening everywhere.
Oh, amateur sociologists.
Yeah.
You mean me?
The second question is, have you seen anything that's really, really interesting among all those inquiries that you get from the sociologists, the real ones?
The real ones. I think I think this is exactly why, say, Facebook and both Facebook and Google have put together. They have gotten real sociologists to look at their data. They're not trying to. They have people in house that do research of like real academic quality, and that is why I don't sit around trying to publish peer review papers when I feel like their people come to us and we work with them to help them understand what they're getting from us and how that can answer their question. So I think I wrote the blog mostly to show that first of all, that this data is out there. You know, this was 2009 when we first started, and that was kind of a relatively transgressive thing. And that there's just interesting stuff you can see about what people are doing. A lot of, like, the fact that men find really young women attractive is not going to blow anybody's minds over at the local, you know, psychology department. So you know, it's just kind of, but like here, you can see it with a precision and a clarity that maybe wasn't present before. I can't remember your small question, unfortunately. So I'm going to have to move on. Unless you can shout it out to me right now. Thank you. Yes. So in doing the book, my editor encouraged me, and I think it made the book a lot better to read papers by sociologists. I found, like, and incorporate them in the book, because I think the purpose isn't to, I'm not going to sit here and claim that anything, whether it's sophisticated work done at Google, is going to replace decades and decades and decades of sociological work. One of the things I found most interesting, mostly because it speaks to what happens at OkCupid, is or it speaks both to what happens and a blind spot that we have. Like, Facebook knows if you're married when we don't. And they looked at, again, with I think people from Cornell, they looked at, what does the social network of a married couple look like, and what kind of, what networks imply durability in a relationship. And they found, you'd think, my guess, if somebody ice cold asked me that question, I would assume that it's kind of like my friends are your friends and your friends are my friends and they're all friends together in this one big, like, spider webbed type of situation. But they found that it's more of like you and your spouse should be a hub, and then your cliques of friends should be sort of disassociated but through you. So you're kind of like in the middle of this thing. You're like the Atlanta of airline traffic, you know? And so, like, which I thought was a really interesting thing. And it is something that we could never know at OkCupid, even though fundamentally things like marriage are our business. So.
You alluded to this earlier, but there was the recent, like, big snafu from Facebook around they're doing sentiment analysis on blog posts and then trying to affect your mood by showing you different posts and stuff like that.
Sure. Yep.
So a couple questions around that. I mean, first of all, like, what do you think about that? So what do you think about that? And then, is it ethical or was it unethical?
Rock on, man. Don't worry about
that. Is it ethical or unethical? And then if it's unethical, if it's ethical, what would be unethical? Like, at what point
is there... I'll answer your last question, because that'll sum all this stuff up. I think it would be unethical for OkCupid, because I don't know Facebook's situation nearly as well as I know ours. One thing we wouldn't do, even though... obviously, every decision we make within a certain scope is towards increasing the number of messages and messaging health on the site. But one thing we wouldn't do, even though it would drive messages through the roof instantaneously, is take 10 years off of everybody's age, or take 10 years off of the women's age. It's easy. We could just simply print it on the page. It would be trivial to do that. But that is obviously a lie, right? That's a fact that we have changed. But for something like a recommendation algorithm, or our own recommendation algorithm, that, again, is the opinion of the human beings behind the code, of who you want to meet, who you might enjoy meeting, or what you might enjoy reading. And just like any person, when you ask somebody, hey, have you read a good book lately? Or I'm kind of single and I'm tired of looking at my coworkers. Do you know anybody can I go on a date with? They're going to have their own algorithm that they're going to run in their head. And you're going to get different answers from different people. And that we are testing those kinds of different heuristics all the time. So I think to pass the kind of ethical test, there's this idea of minimal risk, and the kind of the way that's defined is it a risk that people run in their normal lives? And because whenever you ask somebody for their opinion, you're getting basically a black box spitting out an answer that really may or may not be appropriate for you. That's exactly what's happening with these kinds of things. And the headlines obtain their own narrative, and the headlines get reported on the headlines, and it becomes this thing where Facebook is trying to get you to kill yourself. Yeah, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, and that's something that was actually in an op-ed in the New York Times, and I was just like, what is going on, And so... you know, obviously I have one foot well planted in the middle of the tech world, you know, but I also have a foot in the more like humane or skeptics camp or whatever you want to call it. I just think there was a lot of that uproar was generated by, especially in our case, presenting. I mean, I rewrote about the blog, which is like humorous and cavalier, and people who just dropped into that situation were like, what the hell is wrong with these people? When really the blog treats everything race, everything with a certain attitude, you know. So anyway, it's a good question. Thank you.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
I think we have time for just one more question, very briefly.
We have five minutes.
I was actually curious about failures with the side. Some interesting failures that you've had.
It's a perfect note to end on.
Yeah. Again, because the algorithm, just looking through, I saw the video, and it's amazing how simple yet very clever it is.
Yeah.
I'd love to know. I mean, not just that, just anything.
I mean, our failures are many. I mean, you know, we try all kinds of crap all the time. You know, we have spent months developing and then launched to great fanfare so many features. I literally can't even remember them all. I mean, we developed an app that would connect people on blind dates. So we were making a kind of somewhat cruddy app for a market that didn't exist. Yeah, you know, we spent like a year on that. We've tried, God, we had this thing called Icebreakers, which may or may not still be on the site, but it was this kind of idea where you could, it would slowly reveal facts about the other person. It wouldn't tell you. This is kind of starting to get misty here, but like, you know, it was like, it would be like this. You could kind of click on the thing, and a page would be like, this girl likes the Arcade Fire or whatever, and you're supposed to have a conversation based on that, and then it tells you a new fact about her. And if you guys exchange 3 messages, then it shows you. I guess a lot of our bad ideas about withholding information. So you know, and there's just in terms of the algorithm, you know, that thing is constantly changing. We were bought by Match.com in 2011, and they've been matching people up since 95. And you know, institutional knowledge is a rare quantity in the tech world, just because these companies have not been around for that long. But in their case, they had actually been doing this thing for a really long time. They have a totally different matching algorithm than we do. They look at a kind of network completion thing where it's like matching you based on your type, which they impute by like, if you and I have had a good conversation, they look at the other guys that you've talked to, assuming that we're all of a type, and mm-hmm. then the other women that they've talked to, assuming that you guys are all of a type, and then they connect me around the corner with those people. So, it's cool. And it has nothing to do with your interests or any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And we've tested that. We've just started implementing it and testing it. And it actually, you know, it does as well as ours in a lot of cases. So, you know, it's the next failure may be right around the corner, I guess. So, thanks for your question.
So it is time for our last question.
Oh, right, this one.
This one.
I'm ready.
I warned you about it earlier.
Yeah, I've been warned about this
question. It's an in-forum tradition to ask all of our speakers the following question. So, Christian, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? The clock is ticking.
So obviously she told me about this yesterday, thank God, so I'm not totally flat on my feet, but that does not mean I have a good answer. The options are like some app or the iPhone 6 or whatever, some like very narrow thing or some like broad thing of like more people should obey the golden rule or whatever, you know? I guess for me personally, and speaking to the world that I spend the most time in right now, which is tech, like there's so much about disrupting and basically turning one business model over or one business over and creating a new one, which is kind of like a lateral thing, almost by definition. You're pushing one thing off the table, or like Indiana Jones taking the statue and putting on a big sack of sand. And like I wish that it would be more about building, keeping what's there, refining what's there, and building something new on top of it, rather than sort of exchanging A for B. I guess that's that.
Good answer. Thank you. So thank you, Christian Rutter, for sharing your thoughts tonight.
Last name is key. I'm glad you got it in there.
Yes, I had to get it in there. Yeah. Make sure everyone remembers who they were listening to this evening. This meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thanks, Kiki.